All right. Well, I think that, you know, what's been good, and for people who've been listening to our show for a while, we've had this constant theme that we've been talking about for at least the past 2 months, kicking off with Alan Sack, who really talked about, we're talking about the state of college sports. And our guest tonight, who has been on ESPN's Outside the Lines and many great public shows, talking about this issue, I'm excited to have him on. He's the president of the National College Players Association. Has been very involved in some what I would say is potential landmark cases around this issue, and has been very vocal around kind of the rights of student athletes. And so we want to welcome to the RSG community Ramogi Huma, who is the president of the National College Players Association. Welcome to the show, Ramogi.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to start because I don't think people really know kind of the story and how organization was started. So can you kind of walk us through that process and how you came to even start this movement?
Sure. Well, I'm a former UCLA football player, and actually this group I started while I was still playing football at UCLA. And a couple of things happened my freshman year to drive me down that path. First was I was actually a true freshman backing up an All-American linebacker, Donnie Edwards. Went on to play in the NFL for a long time.
Yeah.
Donnie was a senior, and that year, my first year, he was on a radio show similar to this talking about how fortunate he was to be on scholarship, but the fact that his scholarship didn't quite cover the basic necessities, and that that particular month he had run out of food and didn't have any money and didn't know what he was going to do about groceries. So after the show, he goes back to his apartment and finds a couple bags of groceries on his doorstep. And, he was surprised, said a little prayer, took the groceries in, and somehow the NCAA found out and suspended him. And,
wow.
You know, we were pretty frustrated in the locker room when we heard that had happened. And we understand, most players understand what the NCAA is trying to do with his rules, but at the same time, you know, Johnny was suspended. They're selling his jersey in stores across the nation, number 23, you know, and all of us could relate. You know, matter of fact, by the time Donnie had been suspended, I myself had lost 15 pounds because I went from eating 5-6 meals a day in high school to 3 meals a day in college with a meal card. But, you know, for most students, that's good enough. But when you're burning thousands of calories on the football field, it's not. And, you know, it did get down to the basics, and it was a day-to-day struggle. That kind of just came and went. You know, we felt like, you know, we didn't have a voice. UCLA said, look, we give you guys everything we can under NCAA rules, but we can't change NCAA rules by ourselves. And, you know, again, it came and went. And then later on that year, going into summer workouts, we actually had a new coach, and we had an orientation about summer workouts. And this was a time of year, they call it voluntary workouts, but they make pretty clear that it's pretty much mandatory. You know, and for the most part, players want to go get better anyways, but it's pretty clear that you got to go. Now, at the time under NCAA rules, our compliance officer stood up in the middle of orientation and said, look, if you guys get injured during these workouts, the NCAA will not allow us to pay for any of your medical expenses. You're on your own.
Wow.
And, you know, I wasn't too far removed from the recruiting process at that time. And, you know, I asked every school that offered me a scholarship. I said, well, what if I get injured? Who's going to pay for the medical expenses? And they all said they would. And come to find out, the NCAA won't even allow a school, if it wanted to, pay for medical expenses. It would have been punished. And
wow.
That was the point in time where I felt like players just needed a voice. And I started talking to some of my teammates about it. I had some friends in my high school that had gone on and played for other teams as well, and everybody was saying the same thing. So that following offseason, I started a student group. It was pretty easy at the time. It was just three people with a mission statement at UCLA can start a student group, and that's what we did.
Right.
And that developed, and now we're a nonprofit advocacy group, and we have 17,000 former and current Division I athletes from all sports, and we're the only advocacy group out there, the only voice for college athletes.
The Knight Foundation's 2009 report. Can you talk a little bit about the findings and what that's meaning to the work that you're doing?
Sure. I mean, when you talk about reform and changing the system, towards the top of the list, you're gonna look at the Knight Foundation and the Knight Commission, and it's a body of current and former reformists that are, you know, athletic directors, college presidents, current and former coaches and administrators. And they every 10 years or so, they have really big reports. And in 2009, they released a report talking about how tough it was to get reform done. And they actually interviewed almost all of the FBS college presidents, the top college presidents in the nation. And all of them said, yes, we need reform. And almost all of them said they were powerless to bring forth reform, and they didn't know who could bring forth reform. And that was definitely telling. It backed up everything we've been saying, that the NCAA is incapable of reforming itself, because after all, the NCAA rules are actually adopted and put in place by college presidents. And if this very group is saying it doesn't have the power to reform, then who does? And
that's
for
right.
us, we've been saying, look, reform is going to come from outside pressure, from public pressure, from new laws and from the courts. And that's where we've been focusing our energy. So I think that was it definitely tells the tale in terms of where reform will come from.
One of the things that that President Emmert kind of sent out and allowed for conferences to do is to look at kind of cost of attendance. And so this was something that, as someone who has been a college administrator, someone who's been involved in kind of the admissions and financial aid process, this is something that all students get consideration for. And I think that's something that most people who are in the media or people who talk about it don't acknowledge that. That
right.
cost of attendance is something we use for all colleges. So what's been the big reaction to that? Because I thought that was at least the first step. What's your feeling about that, at least that first move?
Well, and first, just to clarify for your audience, I mean, the cost of attendance is the price tag of the school, and the NCAA caps a so-called full scholarship below the price tag of a school. And
that's
the last
right.
several years, we've been actually doing studies showing that there's a gap between about $3,000 to $5,000 per player per year that they have to pay out-of-pocket expenses. Recently in the fall, the NCAA adopted an optional $2,000 stipend to help try to close the gap, which we thought was definitely a step in the right direction. Not enough, but a step in the right direction. Since then, the schools rose up to fight it, and it looks like they're in the process of watering it down to the point where it's not going to have much of an impact at all. Not only will it be optional, if it's approved at all, the players are going to have to jump through hoops and try to prove that they need it. Our argument is that the numbers themselves show that they need it. You know, the calculations, the scholarship falls short of the price tag of the school. That equals needs. And these guys are generating billions of dollars per year, and the schools are dragging their feet and, holding on to every last penny, despite how hard it is. You know, I mean, from Donnie Edwards, my story from Donnie Edwards when I was starting out, you know, now we have in the media recent stories about something similar. You know, we have Jamar Samuels at Kansas State, who recently was about to finish his last game, walked out to in the men's basketball tournament, but they snatched him up because he had accepted $200 when he needed food as well. And yes, we understand, and we're not condoning breaking NCAA rules, but we're saying that the system is the culprit. You're going to guarantee scandals. This is going to happen all the time. The stipend would go a ways. Look, the kid didn't take $2,000. He took $200. You know, it didn't seem like it was all that egregious, you know, relative to some of the other stories. And you know, as of right now, the story is that it was actually for some basic necessities. But you know, the system turns players who are otherwise worth six figures. You know, we actually did a study with Drexel University. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars these players are worth if they're in a fair market, but the NCAA unfairly gets the schools together and they cap what the players can get, not even to a subsistence level, but below subsistence, below the cost of attendance. And actually, 85% of Division I athletes live below the federal poverty line by about $2,000 per year. So it's important to keep that in mind when we watch the schools drag their feet and fight an optional $2,000 stipend increase.
Yeah, and I think and for people to understand, this is how any student who comes to a college gets that. Well, if your student has a financial aid or an admissions presentation, they'll talk about the cost of attendance, which is books, pizza, and they'll say that's how we build your budget for financial aid. And so what we're talking about is just honoring what we say we do for every college student that comes to a university. So I think these are very important points to talk about. We had this, we've been talking about on our show, and I know you've talked about new revenue and how, and I want to get to some of the things that you talked about, but can you talk a little bit about, you know, what's happening with all this conference realignment and the idea that is creating all this new revenue and, you know, what that means? Because I think people don't understand the context of, I mean, even when people talk about, you know, the educational value, people talk about not having playoffs, all these different things, but yet we have someone like Boise State who is having student athletes fly to the Big East to play football games, you know, every Saturday, when it doesn't make sense for athletes to do that. Can you talk about what this realignment has really kind of thrown into the situation as you're talking about opportunities to rectify this problem?
Sure. I mean, I think the conference realignment, there's been nothing that has made the NCAA's priorities more clear than the conference realignments and that of their schools. It's a money grab. You know, they're breaking traditional rivalries. They're forcing their players to spend more and more hours on airplanes and buses instead of in study halls in the classroom. And they're doing it for money. And where does this money go? How is it spent? Well, coincidentally or not coincidentally, it goes right back to the school and the coaches and the ADs. We have ADs right now making up to $2 million a year. Vanderbilt, their AD makes $2 million a year. And you wonder why they're willing to put these players on planes and sacrifice their education for more and more money. Now, what do players get in return? Nothing. You know, this is something for the ADs, fund money for the ADs and the coaches and the boosters, building luxury boxes in the stadiums and things like that. But, you know, when you're talking about basic necessities, health coverage and stipends and graduation rates, I mean, this is not going to help graduation rates. And if this is about education, then why would Boise State, why would San Diego State join a conference called the Big East when they're all the way out west? You know, this is, like I said, I think it's definitely showing their true colors and the fact that this is, you know, big business. And, you know, I think the NCAA's been given a lot of leeway over the years when they want to call it educational and avoid taxes and avoid paying their players, they call it educational. When they want to go ahead and break up and realign into a conference that will make more money, they say this is a business. So I don't think they can have it both ways. I think the new money that's generated should go towards at least some of it, not all of it, just a portion should go towards basic necessities and bolstering graduation rates instead of ripping them up and ripping up protections and forcing players to sacrifice their educational opportunities even that much more.
One of the things, in the Atlantic, you published a three-part plan to increase student-athlete compensation. Can you talk a little bit about that plan?
Sure. And I always ask the question whether or not players should get more compensation or not, or, you know, and if so, in what form. You know, it was kind of a narrow, I mean, there's a lot of issues, but in terms of compensation, definitely feel that a full scholarship should equal the cost of attendance, you know, just like an academic scholarship. The players are the ones who are generating all the money, and they're out there working hard. It's very hard to justify paying the coach, you know, $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 million a year, and then try to turn around and say, well, we don't have enough for your basic living necessities. So that's the first step. It would cost roughly, if you looked at the headcount sports for full scholarships, you're talking about men's football and basketball, it would cost a little less than $50 million a year. It's not a small chunk, but relative to the income that's being generated, especially the new income, it's definitely affordable. If you were to double that and give it to female athletes in headcount sports for Title IX, you come up with about less than $100 million a year. We did a study with Drexel University showing that there's almost $800 million per year in brand new revenue coming in just from the five of the big conferences and the NCAA alone. You know, there's tons of new money right now, and that would definitely be appropriate use of it. We also advocate creating an educational lockbox for continuing education. You know, if this is about education, shouldn't the NCAA and the schools be expected to invest in education with some of these new monies? You know, especially because they're getting a tax exemption. They're not paying taxes on TV revenue. They're not paying taxes on ticket sales. Our nonprofit, the NCPA, if we were to go out and run a Moneyball tournament, we'd get taxed as unrelated business income. But the NCAA has been given that grace. They don't have to do that. But at the very least, they should be expected to invest in education. Why should a player who doesn't graduate after 4 or 5 years, maybe with a semester left or a year left, why should the school kick him to the curb? Why shouldn't the school open its doors and continue supporting that player until they actually achieve their degree, they earn their degree? So that's another part. And finally, I think that it's definitely hypocritical. I mentioned my teammate, Donnie Edwards. They're selling his jersey in the store. He's not seeing one dime and struggling for groceries. I think if they're going to use players' images, if they're going to, you know, use players commercially to make use their games to make big TV contracts and get paid, then players should have some access to the commercial free market. And by that, I'm not saying professional salaries, but I'm saying allowing players to go ahead and do some endorsements or getting a little bit of money for the jerseys that their jerseys being sold in the stores. It does not turn a player professional, you know, to capitalize on their fame. And I think kind of what I've been saying is with Reggie Bush, you know, and people have a lot of strong opinions about everything that went down, but you know, I personally, and I'm a UCLA guy. You know, I wasn't crying too many tears when USC got busted. You know, as an alum, as a player's rights advocate, you know, I was concerned, but as an alum, I wasn't feeling too much. But I still, looking back, man, especially in the position I'm in, I feel like I would have much rather seen Reggie Bush doing a Subway commercial than giving back the Heisman Trophy. And that's what it comes down to, because the NCAA is trying to enforce the unenforceable, to legislate the unlegislatable. I mean, they can't legislate everything. You can't legislate weather, and you can't prevent highly valuable players from accepting money, especially when you keep them below the federal poverty line. So, you know, we're looking at ways to try to ease some of those pressures and come up with some of the solutions, not just to provide base protections, but also to root out some of the issues that are plaguing NCAA sports, like the scandals and like poor graduation rates.
You talk a lot about it. In you know, my background, I work in higher education and value, you know, and have been a supporter of student athletics. I think there's so much that, and I think you would appreciate that, we learn from athletic experiences in terms of things that are transferable to life skills. One of the things I've been most concerned about is the inability, particularly of players in major revenue sports, to be engaged in the academic process. Is it possible? I know you talked a little about the educational lockbox, but one of the things that have you talked a little bit about rethinking the scholarships right now? And Dr. Sack talked about this a lot. I know Alan is a good friend and colleague of yours, talked about, when things change in terms of going to these non-renewable scholarships. Can you talk about, because I think that's an important thing to talk to about a student about, way back in the day, it was like you had a four-year scholarship and it wasn't year to year. Have you talked a little bit about that? Do you see that going back? What do you think about that in terms of providing that security for players?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. We actually won a pretty big victory. That's one of the things we've been fighting for the last 10 years. And you're right. Before 1973, when from 1950 to 1973, when they implemented scholarships, initially they were guaranteed for 4 years. The coaches lobbied hard against it. They wanted more control of their players. So the NCAA agreed to turn those four-year guaranteed scholarships into one-year revocable scholarships. And that's what it's been like since 1973. Now, most players don't understand that because coaches have not changed their recruiting pitch. They're still promising 4 years. They've still been promising 4 or 5 years. But the truth is that they're one-year revocable scholarships. And by that, I mean at the end of the year, a coach can refuse to renew a scholarship for any reason. We've seen players with 3.5 GPAs doing everything that they could do on the field lose their scholarships either because of an injury or a new coach comes in and they say that, you know, the player doesn't fit in their system. But they really don't need a reason. It doesn't. By NCAA rules, you do not have to have a reason. They just have to give you notice by June 1, and July 1, and that's how it's been. Recently, the NCAA passed a rule. Actually, when they initially approved the $2,000 stipend in the fall, they also approved an optional multi-year scholarship. So schools were able to give up to 4 and 5 years if they wanted to. But the minimum was still 1 year, and actually the schools rose up against that as well. They actually took that one to a vote, and a couple weeks ago, the new rule was upheld by two votes. I mean, hundreds of schools voted, and by two votes it survived. Just to go to show where the heart of the membership is, that half of them didn't want it, even though they weren't forced to provide 4 year scholarships. It's all optional. You know, any school right now, although the rule survived, but if a school wants to provide just a one-year scholarship, they're free to do that. If another school wants to do 2, 3, 4 years, 5 years, that's up to them. But half the membership didn't want it. But it did survive. So I think that that's a good step in the right direction. There are some other issues surrounding that because for a player who's only on 1 year or 2 year scholarship, 3 year scholarships, it's still up for renewal. They can still get rid of you for any reason. So if your school is not participating in that provision, then you might be in some trouble. And we get calls every July from players who had no idea that it could even happen in the first place. Say, how can they take my scholarship if I did everything right? But I think in terms of educational priorities, again, tax breaks, they're tax exempt for their educational mission, yet players could get fired at a drop of a hat regardless of their academic performance. And a player who is in good standing can lose their scholarship, while a player who is academically ineligible might have their scholarship renewed. It has nothing to do with academics. It's business. And that's the reality of NCAA sports.
You're listening to Real Sports Guys. We're with Ramogi Huma, president of the National College Players Association, advocates for student-athlete rights. We definitely enjoy having you here. I want to let the game changer ask a question here. Marcus, I'll let you ask a quick question before we let Ramogi go.
I want you to touch on for a moment, you know, I'm of the video game generation, and I've grown up playing NCAA from back in the days in the early 90s was Bill Walsh college football, playing college football games, playing college basketball games where, you know, there's a guy with a Florida jersey on who happens to be wearing number 5. He has dreads, and he's 5'10 and 187 pounds. But that's supposedly, you know, that's number 5 from Florida. That's not the actual kid.
Right.
How does the whole video game piece using the likeness of college athletes play into your mission and what your organization is working towards as far as helping college players be able to have a voice? In the use of their likeness and use of their abilities to make money.
That's a great question, and I mean it's ridiculous, you know, for EA Sports and NCAA to try to stand up and publicly pretend that those are not the exact players on those rosters. I mean, it's ridiculous. Players know it is. I know everybody knows it. That's a big reason why the fans buy the game, you know. And players don't have any problem, you know, with those entities doing that. But the problem is first of all, they're forced to give up their publicity rights to their schools. There's no option. You know, Taylor Branch, you guys might have, I think you guys have referred to him before. He wrote an article called The Cartel, an e-book, a big piece in The Atlantic, and that's the power of a cartel. If you don't sign away your publicity rights, where do you go? You're not going to play NCAA sports. So these players basically had their publicity rights stolen, you know, and they had two choices, either don't play at all or give up your publicity rights for free. And in turn, we're seeing what the schools have done with that. Supposedly, the schools are there to protect them, and the NCAA, in their words, they protect them from forces of commercialization, and they don't want players to be exploited. Well, then they turn around and exploited players by doing the same thing they said they were going to protect them from. You know, players, if the players are going to be used, they deserve a cut, period. Just like any other American citizen, no American citizen should have their publicity rights stolen and used without compensation. And players are the only group in America where that's happening to. So we're looking forward to the conclusion of that Ed O'Bannon case. Ed O'Bannon from UCLA, proud of him, UCLA alum, going after the NCAA sports for doing that. And he could change it for every athlete in the nation.
Well, that's
all right.
Ramogi Huma, the president of the National College Players Association. Ramogi, we enjoy having you here. Hopefully you'll come back and be
anytime.
A part of this. We'd love to talk to you more about it, and thank you for being here.
All right, thanks for having me.
Game changer, going back to you.
All right, again, thanks again to Ramogi Huma for joining us this week. Greatly appreciate it. Tons of insight. You know, it's an issue that is close to our hearts. You know, I played at NCAA Sports, not Division I. Devon played NCAA Sports, not Division I. And PhD played NCAA Sports, although not Division I. But at the same time, given that we weren't under the demands of a traditional D1 athlete, a big-time NCAA revenue-generating sport athlete, we had a different experience as student athletes. And I think our experiences are more in line with what everybody thinks of when they talk about being a true student athlete. And because of that, we have a different perspective on what Division I student athletes are missing by not being able to truly develop as people, develop as individuals. I have siblings who were Division I athletes. Devon has, you know, knows tons of people who, from his community, his neighborhood, who are Division I athletes. Same with PhD. And for us, this is an issue that always hits close to home because it is, you know, athletics is something that you only get to do for a certain amount of time. And to see entities, colleges making tons of money off of these young men, and them being penalized for trying to benefit from it, to me is a bit of a contradictory dynamic given the educational mission of most institutions.
You know, what you can always also sense from Ramogi, what people miss the fact that folks are still fans. you know, Alan Sack, Ramogi, these folks are still fans of sports. They're still there, but they're fighting for rights. And so I don't want people to confuse that folks are not fans because they're questioning the system. These are still folks who love the game, and that's why they're questioning it.